Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on October 9, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the fourth in a series on the meaning of jhana, or different levels of meditative absorption. This talk is the second on the Samadanga Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches five factors of concentration that relate directly to four levels of jhana. This sutta is remarkable in the scope of the underlying Dhamma that's referenced. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is the fourth, I think, in a series of talks on jhana. As in all the Buddha suttas, they must be seen in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And then the Buddha is very careful in his teaching to explain, and often in a very repetitive way, exactly what it is, because the underlying problem of distraction is what continues suffering. It's what continues ignorance. And so the Buddha would teach a meditation practice that is not conducive to continued distraction, wouldn't he? I mean, it would just make sense when you understand the overarching context of what he teaches. And he knew from direct experience, from studying with some of the foremost so-called spiritual teachers of his time, that meditation is often used to further distraction, just as common now as it was then. So these are entirely relevant suttas. But it's not to give the impression that there's some type of advanced method of meditation. There isn't. The Buddha taught a singular method with a singular purpose, to deepen concentration. But the teachings on the jhanas are important because it teaches us how to recognize that our meditation practice is actually having benefit. It's doing what it's supposed to do, as opposed to the six or seven or eight teachings that I'll give on jhana right now. Really a small fraction of the many jhanas teachings that the Buddha gave, because how important it is. And he knows how easy it is for us to find something that will allow us to continue eye-making and bring it into our meditation practice and call it useful when it's not. And then there's a few things that I mentioned. I'm not going to go through the whole introduction here. But I mentioned some things in the introduction that I want to bring clarity to. And also, this is a rather long sutta. We're going to be here till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning at least. But let's keep, if you have any questions, if you're confused about what I'm saying, please get my attention. But we'll keep our comments and discussion so after the sutta. So one of the things that the Buddha mentions here is six superior understandings. This is often presented as six higher knowledges. And they're often presented in very magical and mystical terms that are unachievable by normal human beings. It's not what the Buddha meant. These six superior understandings are knowledge of personal suffering and the impermanence of five clinging aggregates, meaning the arising and passing away of all phenomena. The second is knowledge of the sixth sense base. And from superior understanding, the sixth sense base is now the ground of meaningful and mindful presence, seeing clearly the manifestations of refined mindfulness or continued ignorance. So we went through a series of practicing restraint at the sixth sense base. And that is also where we relate our well-concentrated mind and refined mindfulness to what's occurring within the framework of the Eightfold Path through our senses. That's what human beings, that's how we learn and that's how we interact with the world, isn't it? Number three, knowledge of the suffering of others. Number four, knowledge of the true and useful meaning of karma and the ignorance that would continue suffering. Number five, knowledge of rebirth resulting from continued ignorance. And six, knowledge of the proper application of the Dhamma and the results, or lack thereof, of a properly developed and entirely integrated Eightfold Path. And those of you that remember the seven factors of awakening, you see how these are closely related to that. And then there's a couple of terms here, just to bring clarity to. Rapture is a word that's often used in the Dhamma to describe a profoundly joyful engagement with the Dhamma. Directed thought has right intention as its motivating factor to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. That's in a very specific sense, but also in meditation, directed thought. It's just the thought to that directs you back to your breath. And you'll see how that fits in with the jhanas. Evaluation in the sutta refers to the value placed on an experience as being either pleasurable or painful. And again, you'll understand how that relates to jhanas, that initially that's what we're doing. As human beings, we're evaluating. Again, that's how we learn. That's how we know we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And as concentration deepens, that need for evaluation simply falls away. The Samadanga Sutta, the five factors of concentration. On one occasion, the Buddha was in Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. He addressed those gathered. Friends, I will teach you five-factor noble concentration. Listen and pay close attention. And what is five-factor noble concentration? A follower of the Noble Eightfold Path is quite secluded from sensuality and other unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana. The first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. The joy of seclusion permeates their entire mind and body. So, again, the Buddha is using slightly flowerful, is that the right word? Flowering words? Flowery words to describe what we all do in meditation. We withdraw from the world, whether it's to a quiet room or at least a quiet space, and we become mindful of the breath. And immediately, whether we recognize it or not, our mind and our body starts becoming united, and our body and our mind calms. And in teaching this, the Buddha is saying, don't miss the pleasantness that comes from that experience. Pay attention to it. That's an aspect of deepening concentration. So again, I would bet everyone that has meditated has experienced that first jhana. Anyone hasn't? Again, the whole point of this is that there's nothing, the Buddha's entire Dhamma is extraordinary, but there's nothing ordinary, there's nothing extraordinary about the ordinary practice of meditation. We all develop this without any extraordinary skills or special dispensations or gifts from higher beings or anything like that, or any mind-to-mind transmission. The Buddha continues, It is as if one poured bath powder into a brass basin, kneading the powder into the water, sprinkling more and more powder, forming a ball of bath powder, saturated and moisture-laden. It would, nevertheless, not lose a drop of its own substance. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body from the joy born of seclusion. This is the first development of the five-factor noble concentration. So again, the Buddha is also offering encouragement in your Dhamma practice here too. Take joy in this. You have found something that will bring you everything you want, meaning lasting peace and happiness. The beginning phase is simply understanding the peacefulness of meditation. And that joy, it permeates your entire being once it's recognized. Now, if we go into meditation with the idea that, and this is an initial motivating factor, and it's fine, but at some point we have to get past the idea that we're meditating to fix a broken self or to find something that is hidden within us or any type of escape or anything that would continue eye-making. We meditate because it's one factor of the Eightfold Path and it's for deepening concentration. And when we can truly understand that, every time we withdraw from the world and enter seclusion, no matter how that is, and become mindful of our breath, there should be joy in that, isn't there? Because we're doing just what we want to do. Nobody's making us do it. Is that clear? It's a good way to begin. My comments here. The Buddha would often instruct the meditator to go find the root of a tree or an empty hut and do jhana. That is his description about going to meditate. And then he taught how to do that in other suttas, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta, and other supportive suttas that speak to the importance of developing jhana, developing meditation. The Buddha continues, furthermore, as the stilling of directed thought and evaluation, they enter and remain in the second jhana. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So first, our joy is simply in the joy of seclusion. And now we're developing joy because we recognize that concentration is deepening. How do we know? Because even for a split moment, a split second, there's no directed thought or evaluation of what we're doing. And again, there's no time frame placed on any of this. Every one of these jhanas can be seen as ever deepening levels of meditative absorption. So when we first start meditating, that second jhana of diminishing directed thought and evaluation is very brief, isn't it, for most of us. That doesn't matter. Again, the length of time isn't important. It's to recognize that your meditation, you are engaging in meditation as it's taught, and that it's working correctly. Joy in the act of developing concentration is recognized as the second jhana. Has anybody not experienced that, the second jhana, in their meditation practice? No? Nobody has?
I'm not quite sure how to recognize that.
Again, even if it's just for a brief moment, you're not caught up in your thoughts anymore. And you're not judging the experience, either I'm doing it right or wrong, or it's pleasant or unpleasant. And again, it doesn't have to last for the whole session, just that momentary, it's a momentary recognition of concentration. Right? Again, for it's
just
hard for...
at that point of recognizing the breath.
Yep.
Being there.
And it's very, very hard for the way we've been taught to not look at evaluating it in terms of length of time. Oh, it was only for 3 seconds that I was free of directed thought. That's no... Just the recognition and knowing, free of evaluation, is what we're looking for. In fact, it's what we're looking for throughout meditation. One of the ways that I say it is always be gentle with ourselves. Don't judge yourself harshly. The great freedom of the Eightfold Path, and in particular right meditation, is that it's so simple and direct that any of us can do it, and all we have to do is do it. I cut you off, I think.
No, that's... I'm finally started to tease these jhanas apart as to, you know, where I'm at that. This is a great suit.
It is, isn't it? And again, this is the reason why I'm doing it, is to make this point. And the reason why I'm doing it right now is it has to do with our last retreat, but also that we're all ready to understand this. And not, my other concern, this is another one of suttas that's been in my back pocket for a little while, is to introduce something that can easily be misinterpreted as a goal. And as soon as we establish a goal, then there's eye-making in it, isn't there? Rather than just the dispassionate recognition, as the Buddha's describing, of ever-deepening levels of concentration or jhana. Clear? So important. They enter and remain in the second jhana. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Free of directed thought and evaluation, the joy of concentration permeates their entire mind and body. And again, I would bet every one of you has had that feeling of just being permeated with the joy of concentration, haven't you? It's just a wonderful feeling that comes from not being distracted. That's the natural state for a human being who is awakened, who's not distracted by continued eye-making. That's the natural state of an awakened human being who's not distracted by continued eye-making. And then I should add, born of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The reason why I'm emphasizing that is we are getting a direct visceral experience on our cushion, as intended, of what it's like to be an awakened human being off our cushion. And at some point in our development, that continues. And that is described in these deepening levels of meditative absorption. The Buddha uses another metaphor. It is as if a lake with no inflow was filled with spring water welling up within, and from abundant showers. The cool water welling up from within the lake would permeate and fill the entire lake. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body from the joy born of concentration. Excuse me. This is the second development of the five-factor noble concentration. Isn't that a beautiful metaphor? That just like that lake is filled up with its own essence, its own spring water, we fill ourselves up. We permeate our very being with this joy born of concentration. From right meditation, from a meditation practice that was taught by an awakened human being. And I can tell you from many, many years of doing all kinds of different meditations and visualizations and all the other things, even in the moment, I might have felt wonderful. It never lasted. And I always found myself then going back into another meditation, trying to find that that self-induced, but illusory quality. There was nothing of real substance to establish, was there, in those different types of meditation. And it wasn't until I actually had an experience of Shamatha Vipassana meditation, the way it was taught, and actually had that experience of simply being permeated with the joy of doing what I was doing, that it changed everything. And it refocused my meditation practice, and it allowed me to really start integrating the entire Eightfold Path on a level that I wasn't capable of before.
In a lot of meditation practices, there's this search for this otherworldly bliss.
Yep.
And it just takes you away from the simple joy of just being concentrated.
Yep. And think about that otherworldly bliss. Where is it established? For one thing, it's established in our thoughts, nowhere else.
Right.
And at that level, our thoughts are impermanent, and so what we're fabricating is impermanent. It's all part of the three marks of existence that are prone to constant suffering, isn't it? You know, again, that's why the Buddha didn't teach any of this. But again, the brilliance is that he recognized it, because everyone else around him was teaching those other things. But he I think I get into it here, but more in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta that I'll teach in a couple of weeks. This is from his own direct experience. In other words, it's not from a conditioned response of not liking these other ideas or other practices. He developed it himself. He experienced it to their deepest level and rejected them from his own direct experiences, not leading to the goal. And then he taught this. Again, you hear me say it often in here, and I know people get tired of me saying what it's not and it is this, but that's how the Buddha taught. And he taught it from his own experience. It's important so we don't get caught up in other things that are easily substituted for right meditation. Furthermore, as rapture fades, they remain equanimous, meaning our minds are balanced in that peace. They remain equanimous, mindful, alert, and sensitive to pleasure. Again, it's an important line, sensitive to pleasure. It doesn't mean that we're now engaged in pleasure, but we're sensitive to it. That's what a mind united with in a body that is calm is also a sensitive mind. But it's not enthralled with its own sensuality. Sensitive to pleasure. They enter and remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, and here's why it's important to be sensitive to pleasure, a pleasant abiding. If we had completely lost our minds by using some other technique that would create a trance-like state, we couldn't even understand that we're deepening our concentration, could we? Because we would be distracted by our own mental trance. Notice that now a pleasant abiding is present. And again, each and every one of us has had that experience, even if it was just momentary, correct? And you can say, no, you haven't.
Yeah.
Because it's an ordinary part of this extraordinary practice. But it's important to recognize it. And it's also important, as we continue our meditation practice, to recognize that these deeper levels deepen themselves. And it's also important to recognize that there's four distinct levels that the Buddha teaches, but that's just really for that's how we communicate. We can't help communicate in distinctions, but there really isn't a distinction between the first and the fourth level. It's simply an ongoing process of deepening meditation. I think I was talking about Saturday about the Buddha, and the Buddha refers to it here using a lake and lotus flowers. A good visual is that when we first begin meditating, our minds are like the surface of an inland lake, and it's rippling, and maybe there's a few breezes that are keeping it rippling. But as we start to meditate, we drop below the surface of the lake, and our minds are simply permeated by that calm that's under the surface. That's a good way to look at this. That's what we're hoping for. And as we deepen our meditation, our concentration deepens, and we're less and less distracted by the things above the surface. They enter and remain in the third jhana, which is equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. Has any ever had a pleasant abiding in your meditation? It's common, isn't it? In fact, it's kind of what keeps us going, but we shouldn't put too much focus on, but we should recognize it. This is a pleasant abiding. It's a pleasant thing to do, especially after a day that's full of distractions and rushing around and all the other things. And come back and just take refuge in this beautiful practice that we all have. It is as if a pond is permeated with, this refers to what I just said, it is as if a pond is permeated with red, white, and blue lotus. Born and growing immersed in the water, they flourish, permeated with cool water from the root, from their root to their tip, never standing above the surface. In the Arya Parayasana Sutta, I think. The Buddha uses the same metaphor, but then he describes those awakening as lotus flowers now coming up and piercing the surface. Wonderful metaphor. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body from the joy born of the fading of rapture. This pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. This is the third development of the five-factor noble concentration. Furthermore, with the abandoning of evaluation, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity and mindful. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness and ongoing pleasant abiding. So that fourth jhana, which is often taught as completely unachievable by anybody today, that's how it was presented to me over and over again, is simply a deepening level of concentration, of that level of concentration that you all just agreed you've experienced in the third jhana. It's just a deepening of it with the complete absence of any type of directed thought or evaluation. In other words, you've gone beyond even thinking about are you doing it right or wrong or what your experience might be or comparing it to anything. Another way of saying it, that pleasant abiding, that mind resting in equanimity, is a mind that has nothing, no shred of ignorance to provoke any movement in its own mind. Pretty powerful statement. But again, it's just for the moment that we build on, and it's important to recognize that just for this moment, I've achieved that fourth level of jhana, and there's no conceit in that moment. And my thoughts related to my thoughts, related to myself, not about anybody else. There's no eye-making left in this thought. And there cannot be any eye-making in a mind that is resting in equanimity. And we build on that. That's the important point, that we recognize it. We know that our meditation practice is as instructed, and it's bearing the fruit that the Buddha taught us to recognize.
To me, the critical thing here is that the lack of evaluation. We're no longer giving it a value. We're no longer calling it good or bad. You know, and as you're getting rid of your self-flagellation, you're giving up on calling it bad. But there's also the point now where you even stop calling it good.
Yep.
You're just there.
Yep. You're just there. And why? Because it's what the practice is. You know, you could take a step further than that and say it's because the guy taught us to do this, the Buddha meaning. You know, we don't need to, if we're engaged in an authentic Dhamma practice, this gets us past any doubt or rooted in discursive thinking, doesn't it? Because we have the direct experience. In the, I can't remember the name of the sutta, there's a Pali word for conviction. It's usually translated to faith, meaning sada. And it's often presented, we need great faith to do this. But we don't take, there's nothing to take on faith. We begin our practice from sada, the right translation meaning conviction, because we understand that an awakened human being did this, he left us his teachings, and we have a well-focused sangha to develop this in. There's nothing taken on faith. It's all from direct experience. But again, we have to know how to frame that direct experience initially, because we don't. We're stuck in wrong views, ignorant of Four Noble Truths. This is a very specific refinement of how to look at what's occurring during a meditation practice. And notice, this really isn't instruction for meditation, is it? It's instruction for it's a suggestion on what to recognize during meditation. Because if we take it as instructions and strive for, well, I'm going to get past those first two levels and get to that third level quick, we're lost. We're gone. We're stuck in eye making. I know it's using something silly that none of us would do. But there's a tendency that all human beings have to acquire things rather than simply develop something that an awakened human being taught. I want to acquire the fourth jhana.
So is it any different than recognizing the hindrances or the aggregates or the... It's just recognize what you're experiencing, what's arising and passing.
Yes, in that same way, and then very specifically, in your meditation practice. But it's also important to recognize when hindrances are coming up in our meditation practice too, doesn't it? So again, see how the brilliance of this human being, he figured out all the things that could take us out of our Dhamma practice, didn't he? Some of it was situational, simply by having the and I'm sure he saw it this way, the wonderful opportunity to teach. Because it was through his teaching that he was able to refine it by seeing what the questions were coming that were asked of him, or the difficulties that those in his Sangha were experiencing it. And almost every sutta is like that, situational in that way. And this is, again, coming back to different teachings on jhana, is because it kept coming up a lot. We always wanted, everyone here, I would bet, I'll speak for myself, wanted meditation initially as an escape. I really thought it was going to be a cool way that I could figure out how I could fly around without my body. I mean, that was one of my initial desires to learn Eastern religion. And it was often taught that way. I read, again, not pointing, I won't mention the name, but I read some of the great books by the great yogis. And that's kind of what they were teaching, that this is a culmination of it. That'd be really cool. You know, I could go to work and sleep all day at the same time. It doesn't matter. All of that was I making, and it took me until I realized what the Buddha was actually teaching that I could put that aside and focus on just deepening concentration. But it's difficult at first. Again, that's the reason why the Buddha teaches it.
Yeah, about 6 months ago, I missed buying this great book called Spiritual Powers for Dummies.
I gotta get that book. I could use some.
I thought, that's cool. And then I...
you practice wise resistance and save yourself $20. But it isn't that, I mean, that's kind of telling on our modern, but that book would have sold during the Buddhist time if they had bookstores too, you know? Oh, if you can bypass all the nonsense and get right to being a spiritual adept. Has a lot of, I mean, again, that's one of the reasons why we substitute other practices, call them meditation, instead of Shamatha Vipassana meditation, because it makes us feel good. You know, we can visualize. Another common practice would be deity worship instead of deepening concentration. I did that for a while anyway. And it was interesting, the state of mind that you develop by visualizing this deity that is now responsible for your awakening, to lead you on the way. And in some of the schools, the one that I took my vows in, you're taught and often counseled to pick a certain deity for the qualities that they have, because then you can develop those in yourself. Avalokiteshvara is a very famous one. Some of the modern teachers always refer to him. That's that Hindu deity with the eight arms, I think, like that. This, if you want to develop compassion, you hold this Avalokiteshvara in your mind, and eventually you'll develop great compassion from doing that. I don't know. I tried it, and I didn't get any more compassion. I just got frustrated. And I don't mean to belittle it by that snide comment. I guess it was, but that was my experience. And just doing that, how can that change the underlying problem of my own ignorance of Four Noble Truths? Simply visualizing something, or chanting something, or bowing, or all the other things that the Buddha said, don't do it. Forget all that stuff. This is the direct path, he's saying. And notice it as it's developing. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness, a pleasant abiding. It is as if one were sitting head to toe in a white cloth, their entire body covered. This is how a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path permeates their entire mind and body with pure, bright awareness. This is the fourth development of the five-factor noble concentration. Again, any of us can have, we have all experienced that. Furthermore, this follower of the Noble Eightfold Path has refined mindfulness well established. Their mindfulness is attended to, understood, and well penetrated by wise discernment. That's when you read or listen to the Satipatthana or the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha is getting into a detailed description of what he's referring to as of refined mindfulness that has now incorporated all the key themes of the Dhamma. But it rests in, as the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta begin, it rests in first developing the four foundations of mindfulness, establishing a well-concentrated mind. It literally can't be done. I'm not saying it, I don't know what's impossible, but I would bet it's pretty impossible to develop a sevenfold path, meaning leaving out concentration. I just don't see how that could possibly, knowing what I know and what we know about the prone, a mind rooted in ignorance to ignore its own ignorance, meaning seeking constant distraction, how could you? Your mind would always be bouncing off of this and grasping after that. It would never be a mind united in its body. It is as if this person, when sitting, knew another as standing. This is where the Buddha is getting very clear about knowing the difference between what it is and what it isn't. As clear as knowing when you're sitting that someone else is standing. That's wise discernment. Or when standing, they knew another as lying down. So too, this follower of the Noble Eightfold Path has refined mindfulness well established. Their mindfulness is attended to, meaning we got to pay attention to it and cultivate it through the Eightfold Path, understood and well penetrated by wise discernment. This is the fifth development of the five-factored noble concentration. The fifth development is simply refined mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, when a follower of the Noble Eightfold Path has pursued and developed this five-factored noble concentration, they have mastered the six superior understandings that we talked about before. This person thinks what they want whenever they want and does not think what is unskillful. You remember that from the Vitakasiddhanta Sutta. Through appropriate mindfulness, they understand the suffering of many from understanding their own suffering. They understand the arising and the passing away of the aggregates. In the more mystical translations, in fact, I won't point out who it is. These descriptions of the six superior understandings almost make no sense, and they're certainly not achievable by ordinary human beings. Of course, the Buddha never taught that. From lack of clinging, they are spacious, free, unbounded, unimpeded. I think in the more mystical ones, it says that this being can now walk through walls and penetrate, and walk on lakes, penetrate lakes to their depths, and et cetera, et cetera. Of course, it just means that we are we're no longer clinging to the form as this is me. We're spacious and free. Their form has no boundaries and no self-distinction. This occurs to a practitioner whenever they are mindful and well concentrated. Their ear consciousness, unbound, restrained, sounds are unfettered and unsurpassed. This occurs to a practitioner whenever they are mindful and well concentrated. When appropriate, mindful and well concentrated, they understand the mindfulness and concentration of others. Often the Buddha was taught as being clairvoyant, but he simply had a profound understanding of the nature of human beings, and he was well concentrated and mindfully present. He could understand others because he understood himself. Furthermore, they know a mind with passion as a mind with passion. They know a mind without passion as a mind without passion. They know a mind of aversion as a mind of aversion. They know a mind free of aversion as a mind free of aversion. They know a deluded mind as a deluded mind. They know a mind free of delusion as a mind free of delusion. They know a restricted mind as a restricted mind. They know a mind free of restriction as a mind free of restriction. They know a spacious mind as a spacious mind. They know a constricted mind as a constricted mind. They know a refined mind as a refined mind. They know an unrefined mind as an unrefined mind. They know a concentrated mind as a concentrated mind. They know a distracted mind as a distracted mind. They know a mind released from ignorance as a mind released from ignorance. They know a mind clinging to ignorance as a mind clinging to ignorance. So the Buddha is describing this from this well-concentrated mind, from a proper meditation practice, we get to understand reality. And we know it in ourselves and we know it in other people. Frank was talking about this I don't remember what class it was, but that you're able to see this in other people now. The defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. And I bet you most of us are able to see that in other people, aren't you? Because you've recognized it in yourself. And that's a good thing, as long as we don't judge other people harshly, but I don't think we do. From understanding our own suffering, from understanding our own confused and deluded minds, we're able to understand it at others. And so, in a very practical way, that brings great peace, doesn't it? Because then we lose that, the reaction to why is someone acting that way? Or why is a political party acting in a certain way? Or why is this going on? Why are there tsunamis and hurricanes and all this? Remember, Brother Ken, my friend, he said, never ask why. Never, if you want to maintain, if you don't want to lose your mind, don't ask why. This was from a guy who had 9 nervous breakdowns. I won't get into his whole story. But he was one of the most brilliant men I've ever met and one of my best friends. I've lost track of him. He used to say, no big deal when you lose your mind, just get another one. I love it. And I'm not belittling mental illness in any way. He really struggled, but he came out of it. Anyway, let me finish the sutta and we can get into it. The Buddha continues, they know for themselves a well-concentrated mind supporting refined mindfulness. That last little sentence is such a key to the Dhamma, isn't it? A well-concentrated mind supporting refined mindfulness that can integrate the entire Eightfold Path. That's why I said any practice that isn't any meditation practice that does not increase concentration and nothing else is not going to support integrating the Eightfold Path. And so because of that, it's simply not a teaching that the Buddha taught. It doesn't mean that other things aren't, they're wholesome practices. They're legitimate practices. It's just different because it's lacking this one thing of a meditation practice for deepening concentration. The Buddha continues, they know the arising and the passing away of bodies within the continuation of endless samsara. This is one of those, another mystical connotations, is they know their myriad past lives intimately and their future lives and the past lives and future lives of all the other beings. There's so many suttas where the Buddha said, basically, get your head out of the past and don't project it into the future. All those suttas on Vajragoda, etc. that we went through, teaching an authentic Dhamma is the category on the website. The Buddha continually says, don't try to establish yourself in the past or the future. The Buddha's Dhamma is for uniting the mind and the body right here, right now, in life as life occurs. There's no value. I mean, if I sat for a few minutes, I could probably think of 20 past lives that I'm pretty sure I had, but I'm also pretty sure they're just pure speculation. Some of them were pretty magnificent. Some were pretty miserable. But I never made it to center field in the Yankees in any of them. So. The point of it is, even if they're true, even if I gave you this story about who I was in this life and that life, what good is it? I mean, it has no bearing on who I am in this present moment, does it? In fact, the only reason I would really want to do that is for eye-making. I can elevate. You know, in this past life, I was a counselor to Cleopatra. Great.
Was she as good as she thought?
Again, it doesn't. There's just no value in that, is there? So even if it's true that we can do that, bring your mind into your body about what's occurring right now. And as the Buddha says, they know the arising and passing away of bodies within the continuation of endless samsara. What does that mean? We understand impermanence. We understand that bodies arise and pass away continually until we bring it to cessation by recognizing and abandoning ignorance of Four Noble Truths. They understand their associations to people and the circumstances of wandering and ignorance. They know karma and they know rebirth. Their eye consciousness is unbound, restrained. They see clearly the continuation of others bound to endless samsara according to their karma. They understanding the suffering of others rooted in bad conduct arising from wrong views. They understand those bound to wrong views are also bound to continued suffering. Furthermore, their eye consciousness, unbound, restrained, they see clearly the arising and passing away of others bound to endless samsara according to their karma. Again, he's just bringing this understanding directly to some central themes of the Dhamma. They understand the release of others rooted in good conduct arising from right views. They understand those released from wrong views are also released from continued suffering. We understand the path. It's applicable to me, and it's applicable to anyone who engages in the Eightfold Path. this is not in the sutta, but just to reiterate, this is what the Buddha describes as awakened right view, is knowledge with regard to stress, and it just relates to what I just talked about. Knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regards to the origination of stress, knowledge with regards to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regard to the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. So you understand this process because you've actually experienced it yourself. And because you've experienced it yourself, you can now understand and teach how other people can do it if you're so inclined. And I'll get to the teacher training maybe tonight. The Buddha continues, thus from establishing this five-factor concentration, they enter and remain free of the defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. They are mindful of their release. We know it. Through direct experience, right here, right now, not in the future, not in the past. They know this for themselves due to a well-concentrated mind, supporting refined mindfulness, my words, of the Eightfold Path. This is what the Buddha said. Gratified, those assembled were delighted in the Buddha's words. Thank you. But listen, what a remarkable sutta, huh? It is a rather long sutta, but it gives a very clear analysis of what jhana means, what meditative absorption means, and how to recognize it in very practical terms. And that really is the point. So we can take this into our meditation practice now, if you haven't already, excuse me, and recognize these deepening levels of concentration. They're not hard to recognize, are they? And this is another one of those suttas that are really good to refer to every now and then. If we feel like we're a little bit off in our meditation practice, you can read this again or listen to the talk again, because it really helps to refine it. All of these articles and talks that we're going to will do the same thing. The Jhana Sutta that I'll teach on Saturday, it's actually called the Jhana Sutta, is another reference to this in a slightly different way. But the Buddha gets into some very interesting and useful details in that particular sutta. So it's coming up. Any questions directly on a sutta? We'll go around the room. Andrew. John,
Could you repeat again the fourth and fifth jhana? I happen to have lost my concentration.
No, that's fine. That's why we're here, aren't we? There's no fifth jhana. The fifth factor of concentration is simply the refined mindfulness that's developed from concentration and integrating the entire Eightfold Path. The fourth jhana, the progression is, and let me just go through it. When we begin to meditate, we find a secluded spot, we close our minds, we become mindful of the breath. And for many of us, especially if we're meditating for a little while, that initial beginning feels good, doesn't it? It's simply, as the Buddha describes it, we're recognizing the pleasure born of that initial phase of taking seclusion. And then as we're sitting there, for most of us, we're going to start thinking about something. We're going to get caught up in our thoughts again. It might be what's going to happen tomorrow or next day, or maybe an argument we had or something. It doesn't really matter. And we recognize that we're caught up in our thinking, and we come back to the sensation of breathing. Now, we might have, in that thought, we might have evaluated the fact that we're not concentrating, we're not on our breath, or we might be evaluating what that thought was driving in us, a good or a bad feeling, pleasant or unpleasant, and we come back to the sensation of breathing. And so as we continue to do that in our meditation, we realize that our concentration is increasing, and those directed thoughts are diminishing. They're still there, but they're diminishing. And our compulsive need to evaluate each and every thought that arises is also quieting or diminishing. And we're taking pleasure now in this deepening concentration. That's the second jhana. The third jhana is that, again, it might just be for a moment, but there's no more of that directed thought. We're simply being mindful of our breath. And maybe it's for two or three breaths. Maybe it's for four or five or a minute or two. But there's no directed thought. There's no over intention towards what we're doing. We're simply being mindful of our breath. And the fourth jhana, and so that's a pleasant, that third level of meditative absorption, is simply an extended pleasantness, using his words, an extended pleasantness from that second jhana of just taking pleasure in that act of concentration, being secluded and my mind becoming more concentrated. And so now it's, you could say that it's lasting for a little bit longer. But I'm also aware of it. But in that awareness, free of and this is really getting into the fourth jhana, free of directed thought or evaluation, it just is. So the fourth jhana is that pleasant abiding, that deep level of concentration without the need for this moment to be any different than it is. And that can be a little bit tricky, but even that fourth level of jhana, we've all experienced it, but we probably can't maintain it for all that long. But that doesn't matter either, because I bet every one of you that has been meditating and incorporating the Eightfold Path for a relatively short while has had an experience of that fourth jhana off your cushion. You've recognized in a situation that might have been tense or distracting for you, and you've been able to recognize, hey, I'm at peace. And this used to drive me crazy. Is that a fair statement that every one of you have had that experience?
Yeah.
Anyone hasn't? But you can't shake your head because I can't see you. I'm sorry. No one hasn't? That's the fourth jhana. You're all super advanced meditators and close to away. It's silly, isn't it? To think that that would be it's just important to recognize that. You are meditating. If you've developed that fourth jhana, especially if you recognize it off your cushion, you're meditating like a Buddha. And again, I'll ask this question. There's nothing really extraordinary about it, is there? Except that the whole thing is extraordinary that we have it. Frank, you had a question or a comment?
I see it as, I guess, recognizing the effort of developing the Eightfold Path. And I think through meditating and then integrating mindfulness and those levels of jhanas, I keep coming back to right view. So everything is guided by right view.
Yep.
And even off the cushion, as you're developing the Eightfold Path in your everyday life, and you become free of entanglements, and you're practicing restraint, your thoughts, so you're not engaging in wrong speech, and you're not engaging in wrong livelihood, and your actions are right, and your effort is good, all these things contribute to the deepening levels of jhana, where I just see it as a natural process. You're free of entanglements.
Yep.
And if craving and clinging does come up, kind of can understand that it is the five clinging aggregates, and you're experiencing a very human part of living, and it just comes back to right view. And it's like that Donald wheel just keeps on going, and it brings it from external experience into a very internal understanding.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That was great. And so there's nothing left inside you to provoke a reaction. Another way of saying eye-making in your own mind. You remain in that pleasant abiding no matter what's occurring. Another way that I'd say that is you're at peace with less than peaceful mind state. So the world could be blowing up around you. If there was something you could do to help others, you would, but your mind is at peace. That was kind of an extreme example, maybe it wasn't the best. The whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma is to go from a mind that is compulsively distracted by continual eye-making to a mind that recognized that process and has abandoned it and is free of that. And so, you know, we talk often about this. What happens when you let go of all those self-referential views? You enter and remain in the fourth jhana. And you are, if you're worried about your performance in the world, the most successful life any human being ever lived was lived by an awakened human being, wasn't it? Really remarkable. Any other questions? We'll go around the room. David was here Saturday too. I'm sorry I didn't acknowledge you being here Saturday. I certainly knew you were here. It'd be interesting to hear if you've learned something additional or something you didn't hear on Saturday that you did,
yeah,
that you did tonight.
I went home and thought about how I go about my day now. And you talked about compassion. And I guess, lack of a better term, there's a right compassion.
Yeah.
And because of this deepening concentration off the cushion, I can now have compassion for a politician who I may not agree with,
yeah.
And I don't get angry. I see that they're experiencing dukkha.
Yeah.
And you know, I thought about that a lot, and you know, I just conduct myself differently when I speak to people, and I speak to a lot of people at work, and you know, they're troubled and have their concerns, and you know, it used to be like a always a confrontation. How do you
yeah.
get through this conversation? And usually it was me. What was I going to say to counter what they were coming at me with? And now
yeah.
it's more of compassion
yeah.
and direct compassion, because I'm not feeling sorry for them. I just recognize that they're experiencing dukkha, and my intention then is right, because the intention is to truly try to understand them. So that's what I took out Saturday,
yeah.
which was neat.
That's wonderful. Thank you. It's a mind that is free of conflict is always striving to end conflict, and certainly wouldn't instigate it by ideological and hateful views, would it? And so you can see someone maybe on a world stage that you might wish they were acting differently, but your mind is free of conflict, so you don't create any more in that situation. That's wonderful. Thank you, David. Lorna, how about you? Second time around for the sutta.
Yeah, me too. This time around it was a lot more pleasant just listening to it, because you couldn't listen to it, just if you once you know the facts of what it's all about, you can just listen to it almost like a story that
mm-hmm.
you're not in other sutras you're often challenged mentally working out the impact of your five clinging aggregates on this and that, and you know, it can get a bit heavy sort of thing, but if you understand the purpose of the sutta and just follow the sutta and understand the jhanas and the description of each all four of them, you can just listen to it as almost like a story, which was very pleasant, just sitting here listening to it tonight. I believe I have experience the fourth jhana, but I also know that if I am sitting just with my breath, with no thought, just observing my breath and not needing to come back to my breath, I'm just sitting with my breath, it's just that's all that's going on. I know that I need cooperation from my body, because I know if I just like lift a toe or something, you know, that breaks the concentration.
Yeah.
You know, any movement from your body, you come right back to eye making, and everything sort of kicks back in again. All that stuff we're trying to get rid of, it kicks back in. So, you know, when I have sort of been in that position of just being with my breath, I kind of like hold my body at the same time, you know, just don't move, because you know, you don't want it to end, but I know if I just sort of twitch or move my head or something, it's gone, that feeling. Thank you.
What do you do after you twitch your head?
We'll have to start the work again.
Come back to your breath.
Yeah, you come back to the breath and start all over again.
Yeah. Thank you, Lorna. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Thank you, John, good to be here, and as always, I take enormous amount of wisdom from the conversations that go on here,
yeah.
and what the members of the Sangha bring to it, and tonight is no exception.
Yeah. It is remarkable. Yeah. Thank you. And what you bring too, Helen. Thank you. Andrew, good to see you tonight.
Good evening. Just hearing the thoughts that others have had, David mentioned when seeing somebody agitated or otherwise that you might be speaking with or being with, that
yeah.
it's just a manifestation of dukkha.
Yep.
And it's an insight for me. I've never even considered that. So the next time somebody becomes agitated, I'll know that I need to back off and not to stoke the fire.
Yeah, that's great. And that will diminish the conflict in your mind, and maybe even conflict in a situation. It's such a great insight, Andrew, and it seems obvious once you have it, doesn't it? But even that statement, the first noble truth, the most important truth of all, is dukkha occurs. It doesn't seem like much until you really understand it. And included in that suffering, you know, when our minds are really rooted in objectified views outside of ourselves, they're always self-referencing, though. So the paradox there is we can't recognize the suffering of others because we're so consumed with our own. But other people are part of that first phrase, dukkha occurs. They're in the world, they're rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, many of them. So they're prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and acting out from that. Understanding, as the Buddha teaches here in many other suttas, understanding our own suffering then allows us to understand the suffering of others from that direct experience. It's great insight, thank you. Ram, good to see you tonight.
Great to be here. And finally getting through to this thing that you've been saying.
Phew, man.
All along, these are not great accomplishments. They happen all the time in meditation.
Yeah.
It's a good thing you don't have such good eyesight, because you haven't seen the eye rolls that I've been doing all these months and years, because I just didn't get that part. And now it's finally teased out where, like, I can see, yes, this is happening.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, and take a long time.
Yeah, but that's just why the Buddha teaches it.
Yeah.
So that you recognize it. And apparently, you know, a lot of people didn't recognize it or don't.
Mm-hmm.
It takes coming back to it and having the right framework for recognizing what's occurring. So thank you. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Nice to be here.
Yeah.
Really appreciate this series, and just would like to spend a little more time with the series and understand it a little more. So thanks for keeping it coming.
You're welcome. Did you get my email earlier today?
Yes.
Okay. We can talk about that later. And this series is going to be, it's going to be a book on meditation. So you'll all be a part of it. But again, it's something else I've been waiting for. I was going to put out remember the pamphlet I used to have, a little booklet?
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be a book, but I realized that it's not proper. It's not right teaching to teach just the method itself without the proper framework. So that's what this will be, all part of that too. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here tonight. Good to see everybody. I don't really have much to add to what I already said, but again, the sutta with the storytelling, I connect it with the pond with the water welling up inside.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said somewhere in there, know your suffering, you can know other people's suffering, and that's really profound with me. I mean, it's like I used to get really angry at people for whatever, for everything, and now when I can see my own clinging and craving, my own suffering, my own attachments, and the hindrances that come up, and what causes it.
Yeah.
Really has developed a deep understanding of other people's suffering, and I do, like, connected with what was said here tonight with developing deep and profound compassion, guided by wisdom. So I can take that away with me tonight. And one other thing you said about the lotus flower in underneath the surface of the water, and then it coming back up through, I didn't clearly understand the whole thing, but I had a connection when I was 6 years old. I drowned in the ocean off Long Beach Island. And I remember sinking down to the bottom of the ocean and looking up and seeing the sun coming through for the last time. And then it was just like a really warm white light. And then there was nothing. But it was real peaceful. And then the next thing I know, I woke up on the beach and I was getting still real peaceful when I woke up. I felt like I had gone, traveled somewhere, and came back.
Wow.
And anyway.
Jeez, who pulled you out?
My mother was a lifeguard, but there was like a bunch of lifeguards. There was a strong undertow.
Yeah.
And kind of got knocked off my raft. And yeah.
Boy, glad the cow didn't get
but
you.
But when you said that, I had a really, I don't know, I had a connection with the way I felt when I was sinking to the bottom.
Yeah, the use of metaphor is helpful for many people, but not everyone. It is, and it, you know, it's prevalent through the Sutta Pitaka too, because it's such a useful teaching tool. Glad you made it out of that water. Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm well.
We've missed you.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
It's good to be back. I'm glad to be here after a little break here. And I think one of the things I really appreciated tonight was just that last little vignette you did of going through the four steps. Because I like things simple.
Yeah.
It makes it easier to understand for me.
Yeah.
I did. When I read this, it was a little confusing. But just saying, this is kind of the stages you go through, and that little quick thing really helped me. So.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, and these are, this is a, you know, a rather intricate sutta, and it takes, you know, you got to come back to it again and again and again, but it really gets to the heart of jhana, too. So. Glad you're here. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to be here. The thing that I appreciate so much about the practice is how portable it is, and the fact that in any given situation, you can go back to the breath. And it's just a good tool to have, you know, because you, in meditation, you go back to the breath. In walking about in life, you go back to the breath. You know, everything that you're doing, and what, as someone who has lived in her head for a long time, it's really nice to be able to pull things down back into the body.
Yeah.
It's what I imagine athletes experience when they're in a competitive situation. They have to get out of their head, they have to get into their body, they have to get their body to move the way they want it to move, and how freeing that can be, and how, you know, high elite athletes work to study on how to get more out of their heads and more into their bodies and away from the thoughts that might complicate what they're trying to accomplish. So it's, on a very basic level, it's just really nice to be able to always go back to the breath, pull yourself out of your head a little bit, and have, whether it's a moment or many moments of refuge, it's just, it's a really valuable thing to learn.
Yeah. Isn't it? And especially when you learn it the right way for deepening concentration. Thank you. I think Barry Sears called that the zone, didn't he?
Yes.
You know, we're in the zone. And
this is
how we can, we can establish that being in the zone for ourselves. It's that fourth level of jhana.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. I don't really have anything that I've come to profoundly. I just think it's being aware of my own suffering. And like Frank said, I think resonated with me, but it's also that when you see your own, when you see something in someone else, it's usually a mirror for myself.
Yeah.
So I just have to have, you know, skillful view.
That's pretty profound. Thank you, Bobby. great class. This is going to, you know, the series is going to continue for a little while longer. tomorrow's video podcast is going to be on from the Theragatha, a poem from the Arahant Dhammika, who describes his Dhamma practice as pure protection. It's a great little poem. That'll be posted tomorrow. Thursday's class is on the Kimsuka Sutta, which fits in with this. It's the subtitle is A Swift Pair of Messengers, and how that relates to a well-practiced meditation, meditation practice. And Saturday will be on the Jhana Sutta, which refines this in a little bit different way. So, and we'll probably be going through this, these different suttas on jhana for another week or two, and then it's going to conclude, I think, if I don't introduce it sooner, with the sutta called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, which is a sutta, you've heard me, I don't know if you remember, I gave a few talks on the Pariyasana Sutta, the sutta on noble and ignoble searches, which is really extracted from this longer sutta where the Buddha describes in really amazing detail his whole search for awakening and the things that he found that were distraction and rejected them and how he ended up with what he ended up with. So, and that'll kind of put the capper on this, these talks on jhana, and then we'll move on. There, Matt and I have been developing our the teacher training here. And we just about got most of the details finalized. We're going to start early next year. There will be a formal 12-week class right here over the summer. So those that teach might find it a little bit easier to do that. It'll probably be on Thursday nights. I say that it starts next year. There's some requirements that would probably take people to develop over the course of a year. And then I think the whole thing's going to culminate with a retreat in January of 2020, just for those that wanted to do this teacher training. The idea is, and it came from a student of mine about a month or 2 months ago, who said, "Hey, what's going to happen to you when the cow gets you? Who's going to keep it going?" And I honestly, I never thought too much about it. I kind of assumed that Matt would take up the mantle, but he couldn't be the only teacher here, I don't think. And many of you have really developed an understanding that you could be teaching the Dhamma. So that got me thinking. I happened to mention it to Matt on the way up to the past retreat, and by the time we were on the retreat, he knew, he had it all mapped out how to do it. So the details will be coming soon. And the idea is that once you're ready to, even during the teaching training, the idea is that you'll teach some classes here, give the old guy a break, and then hopefully there's enough for you to continue, and you'll want to, when, as Ron puts it, Daisy gets me. Move. What's, you know, this is, as the Buddha teaches in the Anapanasati Sutta, what has developed here truly is rare in the world. And I think it's worth at least giving a stab at trying to continue it and maintain what's present here in the world, because there really aren't too many places that preserve these great teachings. So that's that. The Dhana dinner is coming up Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. I reached out to Mayor Meyer, who gracefully agreed to attend. The idea, and again, this is my partner Matt, his great thinking, to introduce the principles that responded to that fire in Galasso's fire. So Mayor Meyer suggested that I invite the borough council, including the president. I think it's a great idea, and also I want to invite the fire companies that and the other first responders. And I think there's about 6 or 7 fire companies that responded. I would really appreciate if a few of you could help me with some of this. So you don't have to decide right now, but maybe even contacting the fire departments, but also with the logistics of the Dhana dinner, I could use some help with. So you know, if one or two or three of you could agree to help me, that'd be great. So if you want, you can just send me an email. But that's going to be Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. If everybody responds the way I hope to, we're going to have about 600 people in Love and Oven, but we'll see what happens. It's going to be, it really was, it'll be a special, and they're all special, but because of what happened in this town with Galasso's, I think it'll really be. And it really doesn't matter how many people. We had 160 people on the first one, and they just kept coming in and out and eating and joining in, so that'll be great. All right, that's it. We'll finish like we always do with Metta. See you, Frank. Say hello to Eric, please. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on Metta from the Kāraniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.